Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. This is Bob Dumel, your host for The Buzz on Technical Rescue. Today is our inaugural show. We're very pleased to have with us Deputy Chief Fred LaFamina from the City of New York's Fire Department, currently serving as Chief of Rescue Operations. He also serves as Task Force Leader for New York Task Force 1, a FEMA-level USAR team, and is also the Operations Chief with the White FEMA USAR IST team. Fred, welcome this afternoon. Thank you for taking the time out of your busy day to talk with us.
Thanks, Bob.
What we're going to look at is with the current situation of events happening in Haiti, primarily related to the request for assistance from different USAR assets around the country. Wondering if you could start out by telling us a little bit about how the USAR system fits into these situations, such as the devastation that Haiti has just recently experienced.
Well, since this is an international response and not a domestic response, USAR really doesn't have any input into who deploys and who they designate to deploy. There are a couple of the national teams, Cal-2 and Virginia-1, who have a separate memorandum of understanding with OFDA, that's the Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance, and they have a separate agreement that when needed, they can respond. But the call for that type of response comes directly from the Office of USAID, and right now they are modifying that by calling an additional 6 task forces from the national level and the RET incident support team as well.
Okay, and with this, so the 2 task forces, one from Virginia, one from the L.A. County area, those I would assume would be our first assets that would have been deployed and on ground working, at least from the United States' support mechanism, correct?
Yes, that's correct. And on the initial deployment, they did activate the 2 Florida national teams, Florida 1 and 2. I believe the reason for that, Florida 1 had been an international asset and had dropped out of the program. But I think they still had enough contacts in place to get them on this deployment.
You know, being a remote island location, obviously the logistics of getting our resources to assist in any issues that they have is another logistical challenge that everyone has to face. From your activities with Task Force 1 in New York City, is there anything unique that the team is going through in their deployment as one of the 6 federally chosen task forces that will be deploying down there?
Yeah, Bob, on that note, the challenges start the minute you get the phone call. New York Task Force 1 was anticipating this, but of course, they are ready to transport the equipment and the members via air, according to all the regulations required, but you run into a lot of problems right off the bat, such as the members themselves. So who's available, who can go? You're going into a foreign third world country where they have a lot of disease. What type of medical things have to be put into place prior to their leaving, such as additional shots, such as that? Passports are required. Even as a rescue worker, you're still required to have a passport to travel to these areas. The biggest challenge, though, is how much equipment are we taking, what type of team are we deploying with, and what kind of aircraft are we getting. All the configurations change. With that, on that note, New York Task Force is still at Stewart Air Force Base awaiting transport to Haiti. They don't have enough aircraft available to the DOD, the Department of Defense, to get them over there. So the challenges actually start right at home. Once you overcome those, the challenges get to a greater depth once you get to the scene. Now to have you on the ground, is there a forklift to take your equipment off the plane? Are there flatbed trucks to take your 5,000-pound aircraft pallets full of equipment to your base of operations, which has not been identified yet? Who are you working for? What are their priorities? So before they even get into the theater of operations, they're going to run into a tremendous amount of challenges. Challenges brought on just in the regular rescue world, and then the political challenges start adding up as well.
And so just from the very phone call that arrives asking for services from anyone of the task force, we can start to see that the picture grows quickly. And when the general public watches the evening news or a small video clip on any of the mediums that are out there, it's very deceiving. And when they see the different task force members affecting rescues and positive outcomes, what it took to get to that point of activity was really almost as monumental as the disaster itself to get those types of resources relocated around the world.
Absolutely.
As we move more people in, we start also probably looking at the infrastructure. I know coming from a state-level urban search and rescue background, I understand how we transport our equipment, and with fleets of tractor-trailers, buses, and various support vehicles, the same thing holds true with our federal partners as well as their ability to go airborne. But now we have to probably address issues, too, of a country that's been devastated by a disaster of this magnitude. What are the road systems like, both after the disaster and then on a daily basis, to handle volumes of tractor-trailers? These got to be issues that are very key in the minds of our logistics folks, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, those are just some of the challenges they will face initially. Eventually, once more equipment gets in, they'll be able to move around better. Communications is a big challenge. What type of communications are they using over there? What communications will the teams use between each other internally within the team? Can they set up their base of operations in a spot where they'll have good communication? So those are just the initial things that are going to hinder them, but just to get into the theater of operations.
Okay. Now, as far as a deployment, kind of for the listener's benefit, kind of go into a little bit on just the general numbers an individual task force would be bringing, what type of operational time periods they would work, and how long do we expect that one unit to be out of country or on site at a disaster?
Okay. These teams all went out as Type 1 heavy use team deployment type umbrella. So you're looking at a 72-man team, self-sufficient for 72 hours when they get in theater, not while they're staging. So 72 hours of operation. With this type of operation, time is of the essence, so they're probably working 24-hour shifts. Okay, so they always have coverage. They're always working. All the task forces that went down to Haiti are Type 1 task forces, as opposed to the light task force, which would be the Type 3. So they're down there with their heavy equipment, the breaching and breaking stuff, the lifting and moving equipment, and all the necessary tools they'll need to operate in this type of disaster.
With this type of deployment, too, we already talked a little bit earlier about the internationally deployable teams from the United States. Also, one of the other things the teams will be encountering when they get there, I'm sure, are search and rescue teams from other nations from around the world that have deployed to assist in this activity. I know a lot of training takes place amongst the task force at various levels throughout the years. You at this point been informed of any of our international counterparts that are also deploying to assist with this event?
Oh, yes, there's many teams. Actually, the first teams in were from China, Russia, Iceland, and they have been operating. I have been involved with some of those teams on a small scale, not in theater, but training and meetings of that sort. And we do work together. No matter what level we come in at or who we're working with, we partner up, and there's always something somebody can do. Somebody will be trained to a higher level, but there's a lot of other things that have to be done. So when we do encounter those types of teams, language problems still sometimes exist. But, you know, rescue's rescue. Basically, we all get along, and the mission is to get the people out alive.
You know, and that's the key point. No matter where you are on the planet, rescue people still seem to be wired the same way. You know, looking to take upon themselves a challenge that others would be walking away from. As the teams are working there, we talked a little bit about your activities as the ops chief with the FEMA USAR IST, in particular the white team. Now, the team that's deployed there today, kind of tell us a little bit about their, in essence, their our USAR incident command system, and what benefits by having an overhead team of that nature on site will they provide to these various teams coming from a multitude of locations?
Well, what they will do is probably, if they go into the ICS system, they'll set up a USAR branch. The overhead command team usually handles that. And any USAR assets coming in under that will operate under that branch. What that does, it actually right now the IST is not in there, so the task force leaders are tasked with being taken away from the actual operation and going to the briefings and meeting with the locals, meeting with the people who are going to determine what the priorities are, where operations will be commencing for that period. So they're faced with some of those challenges. Once the overhead team comes in, they alleviate all of that. I'm an ops chief. I would be at the meetings. I would be meeting with the locals. I would be checking the priorities. And then I would be gathering information to outline missions for the teams for that period. So the overhead team becomes very important in alleviating a lot of the burdens on the team of having to do those planning meetings and those types of things, dealing with the politics. We want them working on the pile, not dealing with the politics of the meetings.
And that's a key point, whether we're traveling out of country or just to another part of the country we live in. The political ramifications of any disaster we respond to sometimes have a tendency of overshadowing the work at hand. And by having that formalized operational group that can work as an intermediary between the guys on the pile and the local leadership community and members of the community is a key tool. I've seen it work very well at various incident command formats, be it with an emergency management assistance team or the IST in the USAR world. When we have these working in place, one thing I've noticed too, and you know, kind of get your background on this in a moment, Fred, is that when the teams can focus on their mission, one, they're much more efficient, and two, the outcome seems to accelerate because we're being more task specific, and I think a lot of what we do is very unique. The equipment that you're traveling with and that the various teams carries is not what the general population would see on a daily basis on their neighborhood engine or ladder truck or whatever type of apparatus happens to be housed in their community. You mentioned that they would be bringing a full Type 1 cache. One of the items that you see marqueed a lot are the search dogs. Would Task Force 1 be traveling with search dogs from their team? And if so, how does this pose travel challenges to the team?
The team will be traveling with their canines, a required amount. They'll have four canines and four handlers. The canines always present a challenge transport-wise, you know, lodging, food, as well as when they're injured. We don't have veterinarians with the team. We're trying to change that policy and get some vets on the team. It is a big challenge, but the dogs have their function also. This type of operation is a little bit easier for us to get into work in theater, being that it's such a disaster and they're poorly trained. The people at, you know, their rescue service, their local rescue service probably doesn't have the training or equipment that we have, and they're just looking for help at this point. You know, usually when we go in, we have to introduce ourselves and let them know we're there to support you, and whatever you need, we're going to do. I think more so in this instance, it's such a the magnitude of the disaster is so great that they just want us to get to work in there and start getting people out. Now, I've been getting all the advisories coming back from Washington, and the USAR teams have pulled out about 27 people alive so far, so we're definitely being effective.
You know, and that's the part that, coming from a USAR background, is great to hear, because so many times much of the mission revolves around a recovery mode, depending on the type of event we're responding to and the magnitude of the disaster. So the fact that they've actually had the ability to create positive outcome for the people of this country already in itself speaks volumes of, you know, what a USAR capability possesses. Looking at USAR in more of a broad overview, budgets are tight everywhere. Many times we hear people looking at ways to cut back on funding. But an event like this justifies every dollar and every man hour spent preparing for any type of a disaster, whether it happens on the mainland or abroad in this case. As you work through the various levels of activity in your life, how big is the current economic situation impacting the USAR forces? Have we been pretty good so far, or is it like everyone, we need to just be aware of what we're doing and deal with the challenges?
Yes, with the climate of, the situation we're in the country, you know, funding has been cut drastically. So, you know, we're being creative and finding ways to still keep up the equipment, the training, the membership, and keeping the members interested in the program and their dedication, which is unparalleled, by the way, through this limited funding we have now. An event such as this, like you said, reinforces the notion that we need this type of asset available, either here domestically or on foreign soil, and that I think a lot of the politicians and the citizens of the country will see this, and they will continue to fund us and support us. At what point they cut that off, that's more about politics. I don't know too much about that.
Very true. That's part of the game that's outside of both of our arenas of play. Okay, looking at Task Force 1 out of New York City specifically, had the opportunity to work with many of their members back in November when we had a large-scale international USAR exercise, Vigilant Guard. Actually, one of our upcoming podcasts will be with a couple of the individuals who were key players in the overhead development of that to kind of share a little more background. But through that event, we had the opportunity to see specifically Task Force 1 out of New York City is one of the teams who participated, along with an international flare with a team out of Toronto, many observers from various international teams, and then a number of other both federally sponsored FEMA USAR teams, state-level USAR teams, and then local fire departments with a USAR contingency working at the various levels of deployment, all coming together, marrying up their skills and, you know, becoming one large, you know, basically force multiplier when we bring them together. Point I'm looking towards next, Freddie, is that an event like this is not a one-and-done. Task Force 1, upon their arrival, will be there a few days after others have been there. How long does something like this potentially go? What type of sustainability issues are we looking at with an event of this magnitude?
Well, the first question is, can they be logistically supported with food and water? That becomes the biggest concern. Okay, so an event like this, I'm looking probably upon their arrival, they'll work between, you know, 5, 6, 7 days, and then it just becomes too much. They're overwhelmed, they're fatigued, and then you have to start having fresh teams coming in. They start the relief, and they start demobbing those teams. But they should be working when they get on the ground between 5, 6, maybe 7 days. Of course, time is critical. A lot of the teams aren't on the ground yet, and we're starting to run out of time. But hopefully they get there and get a few more survivors out.
You know, that would be the best-case scenario. And the ability to have the military assets coming in. Recent news briefs were talking about the arrival of one of the U.S. Navy's aircraft carriers, which one of the or multiple benefits they bring is one, hospital on board to assist with some of the injuries, and two, a water purification capability, which you hit on earlier. Do we have enough water and food to sustain our operations? And this is key, both for the rescuers and obviously the local population. It's had their infrastructure literally destroyed. When you travel, is your initial phase of deployment included food, water, and things of that nature? Do you bring with you what you need to sustain your operation on the first deployment?
Yes, for the first 72 hours, they'll self-sustain themselves with water and food.
Okay. And with this, as we go along, another area hit on that might be worth a little bit more background from somebody with your experience in this. You talked about medical records, things being up to speed, and dealing with the conditions you're going to face there. What are the types of medical concerns that, say, the medical unit of a USAR team would be focusing on at this stage as the team's ready to deploy?
Well, I think initially the docs, which we take on a team with us, would do some research on what's going on over there medically. They came up with yellow fever, malaria, two common ailments that plague that the country of Haiti. That is not a common occurrence here in the States. So the members would have to be immunized against those diseases, as well as anybody not up to date on their shots. The immunizations would have to receive additional immunizations in order to deploy. So that becomes a big concern, because if we get one of the members comes down with some type of disease or cold or flu or whatever it may be, they could possibly wipe out the whole task force for that deployment and be a non-entity, just being away when they get there, not able to operate.
True. It's taking care of your own is equally as important, if not job number one, so that you can sustain both your mission and the health and welfare of the folks you travel with.
Right. Absolutely. And that's a big concern. You know, Oklahoma City, a couple of guys from one of the task forces were eating on the pile. They got some little kind of bug in them and passed it on to half of the team, and then the team was put down and they weren't able to operate. So, you know, that becomes a big concern. We're also there to help, but we have to keep ourselves healthy in order to help others.
Yeah, very true. We don't want our resources to become a liability. We're there to be an asset. And by taking care of yourself, making sure there's proper rest in the day's cycle, things of that nature are key to that. Somebody looking from the outside in may say, well, 72 hours, that's really not that big of a deal. I could do that. But when they take that one step back and see that these individuals aren't only standing there for 72 hours, but they're working in some very extreme conditions, be heat-related. The dangers of the structures they're working in is extremely high. And then, you know, the psychological aspect that we always have to give credence
Absolutely.
To as far as what these individuals are dealing with. Is there anything within the USAR system that you utilize to help with basically the mental welfare of our individuals that we deploy?
Well, we brief them prior to our departure to make sure they know what they're going to be. They're going to see when they get there, what they're going to be confronted with. So we try to let them know what's going on. We have them watch all the reports on TV. Most of these individuals who deploy, we're kind of lucky in New York City. They're all rescue workers, but I know there's other teams that have individuals that are volunteers. So you need to prepare them, but they might not see things they're accustomed to seeing. And equally as important, their mental status has to be evaluated while they are operating in theater and constantly reevaluated to make sure they're not overcome with whatever grief, sorrow, whatever it may be, and take their focus away from their main mission, which is there to help people. And as leaders, we have to recognize these things. And then when we get back, We don't send them back right away to work. We give them a little debriefing and make sure everybody's okay before they go back to work or back to their daily routine.
Definitely a good idea. You know, it's so important to take care of your own if your own is going to be expected to take care of others. This is the type of deployment that it builds both the capabilities of a team. As we all know, we can train as often as we possibly can, but it's the actual deployments that polishes our skills and makes these teams that much stronger for the next time they go out.
Exactly. And those shortfalls, they're really not shortfalls. They're just challenges that come up that the manuals don't tell us about or that we trained on. And then we'll confront them with them and have to deal with them. And then we do deal with them, but then we come up with better ways to deal with them in the future. And again, that comes down to experience. And having the experience is better than any textbook you'll ever read.
I definitely have to agree with you on that, Fred. And as you look at the team deploying, I'm sure you'll be in constant communications with them. Hopefully, if your schedule allows, we'd like to have an opportunity in a few days maybe to talk again, update our listeners as far as, you know, how things are progressing, if there's any status reports or things that you're capable of sharing. I think this is a very timely issue. And those in the technical rescue community understand to a degree what's involved here. Some are very active in teams themselves. Others have interests within their community, and some are just the new members of the department looking for that direction to take. And technical rescue is definitely one of those areas that appeals to many because it's more of a hands-on functionality within the emergency services. So, Fred, I'd like to thank you for your time today, all the great information you were able to share with us. And we hope that future episodes of The Buzz on Technical Rescue, you'd be willing to share your time as a guest. This is Bob Dumel with Radio@Firehouse.com, thanking our listeners today, and we'll hope to be talking to you all soon. Bye.
Thanks, Bob, and everybody be safe out there.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@Firehouse.com. Thanks for listening. And stay tuned to Firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.